Hello, my name's Tom Walker. Welcome to That'll Be the Day. Now, normally in this podcast, I try to speak to interesting visually impaired people who've got a story to tell. But this time, I'm doing something slightly different because I'm going to be talking to a man who grew up in apartheid South Africa, who took an active role in the African revolutionary movement. But before we hear from Dave Evans, if you like the sound of the music at the start of this podcast, it's a track called That'll Be the Day by the Liverpool band The Vow. And as always, I'll be featuring a track by the band at the end of this podcast. To find out which one I've chosen, stay tuned. That'll be the day. Dave Evans leads a quiet life these days, living in Wallasey near Liverpool with his partner Jenny Newman. But when he was growing up in South Africa in the 1940s and 50s, he was slowly becoming aware of the injustices the apartheid regime was inflicting on people from the black and minority ethnic communities. This is Dave's story. And with me now in his front room is Dave Evans. Dave, nice to talk to you.
Oh, hi. It's great to meet you, Tom.
How did you end up here in Wallasey?
I met Jenny. She lived here, and I fell for Jenny. That was about 40 years ago.
What do you make of the UK? What do you make of the state of the UK these days?
Well, it's a troubled country, but what country isn't? You know, and it's been good to me, really. So I take it from that point of view. I don't like the Tories. You know, I have been a member of the Labour Party and now I'm a member of the Greens because Labour seems to me to have moved to the right as well. This may be offensive to a lot of people, but I am a lefty and proud to be.
You use the word troubled country there, and of course your country of origin is South Africa. And when you were born in 1935, that was well and truly a troubled country.
Indeed.
What kind of country were you born into, for people who don't know? What was South Africa like in 1935?
In 1935, and the years I was a schoolboy, it was a white dominated country. The white majority dominated it. And whether it was the United Party or the Afrikaner nationalists, there was still a form of segregation which was unfair to the majority black population. And my sense of growing up was we had a servant and we had a gardener who was later recruited for the mines. And I was very impressed by the gardener, who was a strong guy, you know, and good to the dog. And gradually, my views, which were normally kind of racist, you know, shifted. And after school, I became, by which time the Afrikaner nationalists were well embedded. They had come to power in 1948.
What do you remember of the nationalists coming to power? Can you remember the election that, which they presumably won?
Sort of, because the disappointment of my parents, who didn't like the idea of an Afrikaner nationalist regime. And so I didn't, to begin with, and followed my parents' view. But once I left school in 1953 to work on the local newspaper, the Queenstown Daily Representative, which was anti-government and run as a sort of business owned by an old Scotsman, A.K. McPherson. And I went to work there as a cub reporter.
You would have presumably wanted to go to university. That would have been the expectation of the school you went to, would it?
Yeah, I won English and debating prizes at school. I didn't become first, second or third. I became fourth or fifth in the general thing. But I won the English prize year after year. And I also, which affected my career, I think, and I also won the debating prize 2 years running. that we were beaten by this girls' school, which sharpened up my knowledge of what girls were capable of, because I was an only child.
And the school was quite traditional, wasn't it, in many ways?
Oh,
traditional,
yeah.
School uniform?
Yeah, striped blazer, grey longs, tie, white shirt. You could dress informally some of the time,
And what did the school teach you about the world, and how did it inform your views?
Well, I was taught English and history, but the history tended to favour the white point of view and sort of rubbished dissident ministers, was anti-Catholic, for instance, though my mother's best friend was a Catholic. And when my father died, I stayed with the Catholics while my mother was recovering from her grief.
Would it be fair to say that you held mildly racist views while you were at school?
Yes, yes. And although we sometimes threw train pillows out of the window onto the track or beside the track, knowing that black South Africans would collect them and get a few coppers for handing them in. So it was a mixed thing. But on leaving school, as I say, I became a reporter, led by the then chief reporter, a guy called Sparks. And Sparks became editor of the influential Rand Daily Mail.
And did working as a reporter change your viewpoint? Did it open your eyes?
Yes, it did. And things I saw, and as I say, getting into discussions with black people. There were meetings of the ANC in the African township, as it was called, the location. And on one famous occasion, for me, I was going in with two black guys who were going to show me how a housing scheme was failing to work properly because of wet foundations. And the white location superintendent stopped us and said, what were we doing? And I told him. And he said, you're not allowed to go in here. You can't go in here. But I'll give you a lift back to the white township. And I said, well, these two blokes brought me, these black men. Will you give them a lift as well? And he said, no. And I said, in that case, I'll walk. On the staff was a man of colour. He heard about this. He'd introduced me to those two ANC guys. He was quite militant. And he got hold of that story and he embellished it. And in his version, I'd told the location superintendent, the white superintendent, to get stuffed, which did me good with the ANC, but not with some white people. So I began what was then a slow conversion to first liberal views. I wrote to Alan Paton about his book, for instance. I went to what was then Rhodesia because I believed the nonsense Sir Roy Walensky was talking about how liberal they were, and I thought that was better than South Africa, so I'd work there. I worked for the Rhodesia Herald of the time and learnt from black people in Harare, which was Salisbury in those days, that blacks were oppressed there like everywhere else. And eventually the company I was working for transferred me to Northern Rhodesia, as it was then. And I worked in Ndola and on the Kitwe Copper Belt. And again, I met an African trade unionist called Lawrence Katalungu, who was quite a conservative man, but a damn good trade unionist. He wasn't African National Congress, but he was anti-black oppression and a good unionist. And that changed my views considerably. because I used to get brandy for Lawrence. Not a lot, but such was the system. He had to declare how much spirits he bought. So he got some of us white guys on the paper to act as his donkeys, you know. And it made for friendships. And then that was going on. So I got kind of accustomed to talking to black people and black lives. And then eventually thought, what the hell am I doing in the Rhodesias, which they were then, when my own country is seething and bubbling and certain people have been put on treason trial. There was a treason trial of white liberals, black militants and so on going on. And I thought, why don't I get back there? So I also, there was a pretty girl from Life's Complex, isn't it? There was a pretty girl from Natal at the University of Natal. And I fancied her and she was going back. So I, in a way, I followed her. So down I went to Durban. And as part of the Argus Company group of papers, and worked for the Natal Daily News as a general reporter. And while I was there, an interesting thing happened. I was sitting, and a guy had given a lift, a black man, Davidson Katsera, who was a Zimbabwean, a black Zimbabwean, also known, his real name was Sotai Katsera, but he passed as Davidson for English-speaking people. And I'd given him a lift down to Durban where he was at university. He came to see me. I think it was Sotai who came. Anyway, a couple of black guys came in. I was in the reporter's room of the Natal Daily News. And it happened, a member of staff who also happened to be black was passing by with tea. And I asked him to give cups to my black visitors, which he did. And they had, and we chatted away. And they went, you know, it was just amiable stuff. And two of my colleagues, white colleagues, reporting colleagues, came over to me and said, we're going to have to smash those teacups. And I said, what do you mean? Said, well, look, they said, look who drank out of them. And I said, for heaven's sake, you know, cups get washed. And they said, nonetheless, they should be smashed. And then they pushed off, not getting anywhere with me. And there was a kind of horrid silence in the reporter's room. And two guys crossed over to me and said, good for you, with you. One was Michael Goldberg, and the other was Jolyon Nuttall. Both had turned out liberal men, and they were just horrified by the way my other colleagues had behaved, these other colleagues. And so, but that gave me an idea of what I was coming up against. And it also gave other people the idea of the sort of person I was becoming. And there was a reluctance, for instance, on the paper to interview members of the ANC or the Indian National Congress or the Coloured People's Congress, all elements of the so-called Congress Alliance. Why I didn't join the Congress I was invited to was partly I didn't like that structure. I preferred the Liberal Party structure. My views changed in time. You know, as I moved leftwards, I saw the reason for things and learnt a bit. But that made me an uncomfortable member of staff on the Natal Daily News.
So how did you move from the Natal Daily News to basically an underground resistance movement, the ARM?
I'll tell you, it is. I'm being a bit long-winded about this, but I applied to a Liberal paper in Port Elizabeth, run, I knew, along Liberal lines, and didn't immediately get a reply. But anyway, my roommate in a flat in Durban was leaving for some reason or another, and so we gave a party to whom we invited everybody we knew. And it contained a lot of young people, some of whom were black, some of whom were mixed heritage, some of whom were white. We were raided by the police for creating a disturbance. Somebody in the block of flats where we had our flat had reported us, and we were charged with creating a disturbance. And that caused quite a hubbub in Natal. And we were shepherded off that evening to the police station, where it was chaos, because there were so many of us, and some of my friends who were there had managed to get hold of a police helmet, and one of them, a black guy, was walking around in it. The staff, white and black, were sort of going along fairly happily while they took the details of the charges against us and me. In the end, we came to court, and the charges were thrown out, largely because a very astute lawyer said, what were the people actually doing? And it turned out all we were doing was drinking, which we weren't supposed to do, but that it wasn't a really definable crime, and dancing. And there were descriptions in court from black people of how harmless the behavior was, basically. And a white woman who'd complained was beautifully questioned by our lawyer, who said, when you were young, did you not dance? And she was old, and I think like our lawyer, Jewish, and she said, yes, I loved to dance. And the case collapsed. Our lawyer sued for wrongful arrest, which meant every member of the party, and I think there were about 23 of us, got a sum of £25 from the state, except me, because I was the host. And for some reason that I didn't get anything. I wasn't charged with anything further. So again, my sort of notoriety increased. But by then I'd applied to work in Port Elizabeth on the Evening Post. And going back to my flat after the police took me home, sitting there among the sort of wreckage of the party, through the mail came a letter saying I'd got a job on the Evening Post in Port Elizabeth. So I went to Port Elizabeth and was a reporter there until Sharpeville, I think, when censorship was applied to newspapers. And I couldn't take it. I did an impulsive and foolish thing of the type I often do. I quit and said I would freelance. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. But I left and for a while had no job and was wondering what would happen to me. And Alan Payton phoned me from Durban and said, come and work for me doing research on a book I'm writing, which happened to be about a Liberal, an early Liberal person. So I worked for Payton for several years in Durban. That enabled me to carry on agitating, being a loudmouth. Basically, I think I went to jail because I was a loudmouth rather than my membership of the African Revolutionary Movement.
What was the official reason you were arrested? What did it say on the indictment papers?
I think crimes against the security of the state.
But did you actually ever commit a crime against the security of the state?
I had possession of dynamite And I was arrested with another man, John Laredo, a liberal academic who also had dynamite. What happened was the organization which I joined then, which was the African Revolutionary Movement, I think the ARM, was into sabotage, blowing up pylons, not people. They were a damn fool called John Harris, put a bomb on a station, which blew up before the police could get to it. He said afterwards that he wanted the station disrupted. He didn't want to take life. But in fact, the bomb killed an old lady and scarred her granddaughter, I think. It was a terrible blow to us in the ARM. It was quite contrary to policy, but it made it easier. The police by this time were raiding me quite regularly.
So you were guilty by association, effectively?
In a way, but also I had dynamite.
Which is serious.
Yeah. And others, my fellow man, John Laredo, the academic, he had detonators and dynamite.
Put the two together, yeah.
Yeah, we hadn't used it, but the intention was clear. And so both of us were charged, I think it was crimes against the security of the state, but possession of dynamite and the do-it-yourself sabotage kit featured in the trial. And we both got 5 years, defended very ably by a very good QC. And his partner was friendly with my then wife. I'd married a woman in Durban during my stay in Durban. And so I got a free defence from this very good barrister.
As you were being sentenced, yeah. Can you remember what the judge said to you?
I can't well, you know. The judge had once given me a lift while I was hitchhiking, and I'd also testified at a divorce to which he presided as a friendly witness to the divorced couple and the person they were divorcing from. So he was Justice Kennedy, I think his name. Whether he recognised me, I don't know. But he gave us 5 years.
Was that lenient, do you think, under the circumstances?
Yeah, I think so. It was, in a way, a gift. Because in my 5 years in prison, I had no degree, because my mother, who was a widow, hadn't had the money for me to go to university.
You've described prison as being a bit like a socialist campus. What did you mean by that?
Well, my part of it was, I mean, I was put in prison in Pretoria, the heart of nationalism, if you like. And others in prison included members, all whites, but in a prison mainly built for it. I think it had held people that Cecil Rhodes had sent to rebel against Creer, against Paul Creer. But in there with me were members of the Communist Party, members of the Congress of Democrats, usually lefties, sometimes communist, liberals, people who weren't part of the ANC. I wouldn't join the ANC because I wanted to be a member of the ANC, not of the Congress Alliance. I was not anti-Marxist, but I was a bit anti-communist.
How aware
in those years?
How aware were you at the time of Nelson Mandela, who's obviously the towering figure of anti-apartheid movement?
I think I was aware of him, because I think at the time I went to prison, which was in 64. I think he had replaced Luthuli as the leader. So obviously he was a coming figure. And also he was from the Transkei. And I knew that, but I never met him.
You met his lieutenants, sir?
Some of them, yeah. Moses Mabhida, who I think became Minister of Defence later, and others, young people. In fact, generally, in my lifestyle, prior to arrest, I'd tried to live the way various African friends live, as though there was no apartheid. I mean, just nonsense. You couldn't. But, you know, we had black friends to stay, and we had parties. We drank with black friends. We went into the veld near the river with wine, and so on. A lot of people did that sort of thing.
While you were in prison, you did a degree.
Yeah.
Which you hadn't been able to do when you left school. What was it like generally in prison? Were you treated well, or was it quite harsh?
It was quite harsh in a way. They were very slow to promote us to, you know, there was a grading system. When you first came in, you weren't allowed smokes. You weren't allowed a newspaper. That sort of thing continued with us for a long time.
That must have been quite difficult for somebody like you.
Yeah, and for the warders in the main were sort of all right. They were hostile, but one of them, the chief warder, Barney John Dupree, was somebody we didn't like at all, and he was heard saying to a friend in an Afrikaans conversation overheard by one of us. He was asked if he het jy hulle gery, did you ride them? Meaning us, meaning the politicals. And he said, yeah. So we knew from that, well, we knew anyway that he didn't like us. But he stuck to the letter of the law. It was bearable.
Did you have freedom of...
all warders were horrible.
Did you have freedom of association with other prisoners, or were you restricted in that regard?
I was restricted to my fellow politicals. I mean, we were known as a political group. At one time, during my 5 years, we were transferred from Pretoria Local Prison to Pretoria Central and mixed with the others, with common law prisoners. Eventually, I think after about 11 months, they took us back to Pretoria Local, where they'd built a special section for us.
Were they concerned that you would convert the other prisoners to your way of thinking, in the same way as Nelson Mandela did with his prison guards on Robben Island?
That's right. They feared that. And so the thing of going to Pretoria Central was rare, and it was only while they were building a special part of Pretoria Local Prison for us. But we were meant to be kept away from other prisoners. It so happened that I witnessed an attack by a warder on a black prisoner, which was, I saw through a grill, a gate, what he was doing, which was knock the guy to the ground. Just playfully, you know, wham, hit him. Knocked him over. And one of us, Harold Strachan, leaving prison, gave a report to the newspaper about, which included that incident. So I was called to give evidence, which the magistrate heard, because Jock was charged with perjury, I think. The magistrate said my evidence was faultless, but I was politically motivated, so he had to reject it. And Jock came back to prison for perjury, treated as a hero by a lot of common law white prisoners, because he exposed conditions. An interesting man, Jock Strachan, did know.
So when you left prison, what was life like for you then in South Africa? Were you able to work? Were you able to carry on with your life as normal?
I should say that even before I went to prison, which was 1964, as I recall, in 63, I was handed a banning order under the Suppression of Communism Act. I was a critic of communism. And that banning order wouldn't allow me to write publicly, speak at public meetings, or leave my residential area. So it was a kind of confinement order. I could live with my partner, I was then married, and I could meet one person at a time, often in a park, but often watched by the special branch. So when I came out, all that still held true. I wouldn't be able to write or work in my job. I'd been a newspaper man and for a while a copywriter in an advertising agency. But I wasn't going to get a job. So my wife and I came to Britain, where my wife's brother, who was also a liberal sort of guy, had been at St. Catherine's College in Oxford. So St. Catherine's accepted me for a second degree.
How easy was it for you to get out of South Africa? Did you have to battle for that? Or were they just glad to see the back of it?
It was an exit permit which said I couldn't return. That, of course, fell away when official apartheid ended. But for years I couldn't return. I'd have been arrested.
When you left South Africa in around 1970, did you have any grounds for hope or optimism, or were you still very, very depressed over the way the country was moving?
I was in some ways depressed. It was very slow. But I believed, I never ceased to believe, that apartheid would collapse. And actually black friends, and Jordan Ngubane, who was a prominent liberal black, said apartheid will collapse when whites recognise the disaster facing them. And I believed that would happen in time, because the struggle would continue. And when I came to England, I spoke at quite a few meetings against apartheid.
Are there any parallels between what was happening in South Africa and what's happening in Israel-Palestine at the moment?
Well, South Africa is clearly drawing those parallels. For me, it's a very difficult thing, because I can see the sides. After all, in prison with me were Jews, who I'm sure are in anguish over what's going on. And their anguish is they don't want the state of Israel to be fighting Hamas, and which seems to be under Netanyahu. And this is the dilemma of all liberals, I think. Netanyahu seems to think that he's got to kill off the entire Gaza population. Now, that's how I read his attitude, or that they're going to hit Gaza so hard with bombing and so on, and the Israeli army is clearly very efficient. So I'm not anti-Semitic, but I'm staying out of arguments about that particular conflict. So, but I'm very distressed, because there were Jewish comrades in prison, there were Jewish comrades at school. I didn't call them comrades, but we played cricket together and so on. I am not, I insist, anti-Semitic, but I am distressed by the situation.
you came to the UK at a time when the whole society, if you like, was liberalising. There was quite a lot of legislation in the 60s. Had opened things up on things like abortion and other issues.
Yeah.
The contrast must have been massive for you to come here.
It was. It was. And I did believe that apartheid was going to collapse, but was surprised how quickly it happened, really, which was sort of, to put a date on it, the 90s, wasn't it? 94, thereabouts. And I could go back, and did. Jenny and I went. And it was great going back.
What did you do when you came to the UK? Because you graduated from Oxford University, and then...
I got the BPhil, a second degree, which was a gift. I mean, that's apartheid's gift to me, was to make it possible for me to get an Oxford degree, which, as you probably know, is a kind of ticket to jobs. And so I'd sworn as a kid I would never become a teacher. My mother wanted me to become a teacher. I said, no way, I'm going to be anything but a teacher. But what if I became? When I left Oxford, I got a teaching job in Wales, where I was very happy. And then a friend from Liverpool that I met in Oxford, a working class genius sort of guy, you know, very bright and therefore in Oxford. He wrote to me from Liverpool and said, come to Liverpool, there's a job going. I came, and to my surprise, I got it with what's today the Department of Continuing Education. It's called Extension Studies with Liverpool University. So I became an academic and a teacher.
And also a writer. Here we are in your front room, surrounded by books. I just look around and there's books behind you, to the side of you, behind me.
Mainly Jenny.
Mainly Jenny's book. Yeah, but you've written a fair bit as well yourself.
Yeah, I had a play on television.
The Reunion.
The Reunion. And I had a play on Beneath Olympus was on stage. And quite popular in Liverpool. The Reunion was also on stage in Liverpool.
And there are hundreds of short stories as well, aren't there?
Yeah, a publisher has published a lot of my short stories.
And to what extent do they draw on your experiences in South Africa and then subsequently here?
The stories are varied. I'll give you a copy.
All right, that would be good.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen a couple of them, which is why I asked you that.
I also wrote a novel. I'd like to write more, but I haven't. Jenny's into her third. I don't know if she's mentioned that.
She hasn't, but I did know that Jenny's also
a
writer.
She's published too. She's a better writer, let it be said. But I've been very lucky, though I feel I've underachieved as a writer. Even though I'm nearly 90, I'm going to write a bit more yet.
Do you find it hard to knuckle down as a writer?
I am at the moment, and I was working in collaboration. I'm not a good collaborator with a friend who died, you know. And we were writing a television series, we thought. And I've still got that to look at and a whole lot of half pieces. But the two solid things are the novel and the book of short stories.
I'm guessing you still keep a very close eye on South Africa and have done so. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, how did you feel about that? I imagine you must have been absolutely overjoyed.
Great, great. I became a great admirer of him.
How do you feel he ran South Africa as president?
I thought he was good. I don't know about his... He had a lot of good... a lot of good lieutenants who were competent and brave and so on, Walter Sisulu and others that I met. And in Durban, I knew quite a few they're not names, but they were very hard-working members for the African National Congress or the Indian Congress and so on.
There was a...
So I was delighted that there was this lineage literally to Mandela. When and I'm sorry I never met Mandela. I could have, but there was no particular reason to.
When you think of his obvious and very conspicuous lack of bitterness over having been kept in prison for 27 years, I mean, did that lack of bitterness surprise you in any way?
Yeah. I met a South African friend when I went back, who was by no means a liberal, but not illiberal either. He met Mandela in a lift, and they got chatting in Xhosa, because my white friend spoke Xhosa, the African, it's very like Zulu, you know, it's a, and they spoke in Xhosa and English, and he was ravished, really. And Mandela had such grace when he was here in England, and Adelaide Haynes, I don't know if you've heard of her. You've heard of Haynes, Lord Haynes.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
His mother,
right, yeah,
was very active in liberal politics. Mandela was going through London and heard that Adelaide was in hospital. He went to see her because he remembered what she'd done in Pretoria, going to hearings of Africans caught and convicted under the past laws.
Of course, Peter Hayne was a very prominent anti-apartheid campaigner himself.
He was, yeah. He's built his reputation on that, yeah. Yeah.
When you think
he's
of...
Lord Hayne, though.
Lord Hayne. Oh, he's important now, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When you think back on Nelson Mandela, what do you think his legacy will be for South Africa and for the wider world?
I think he did a lot... grace under pressure, grace, friendliness, willing to see that the struggle not as just to liberate black people, but where black and white could live together in amity and, you know, goodwill. I think that's his heritage. And his legend, really.
There's been some acrimony within the ANC since he stepped down as president and sadly died. Do you feel that in any way he could have left the party in a stronger position?
Hard to tell. I think, you know, he was a human being. And, you know, I'm sure there were shortcomings. I mean, he was going around a lot, publicising South Africa and so on. He couldn't do everything. And I'm not sure that... I really don't know. I hesitate, as you can see, to criticise the OK, but I'm sure he left something to assistants which weren't really properly done, you know.
And when you look
but
at...
that's true of practically every leader, isn't it?
I mean, he's almost perfect, though, isn't he?
Oh, yeah,
almost.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, he now that he's no longer with us, of course, the reputation is there.
I mean, I've always regarded Mandela as being the greatest living person that I'm aware of.
Yeah, that's not a bad judgment. I would go along with... I don't know the others, but I know I'm very impressive. And I admired his thing. He could, you know, he carried out that thing. If you can walk with crowds nor lose your virtue, that's Kipling, isn't it? If you can talk with kings nor lose the common touch. And it goes on and on.
Yeah.
And you're a man, my son. And he lived out that bit of Kipling, I think. Although Kipling was an old imperialist.
Could I just ask you about the current state of South Africa? How well do you think Cyril Ramaphosa's doing as president, and what direction's the country going in now?
I think he's battling. You know, I think unfinished business is surfacing, and it's a hard one. I would say South Africa is a bit troubled now, and that Ramaphosa's facing difficulties. I don't know him personally, never met him, but he's clearly a clever man. But he worked for a big business at one point. He's quite well-to-do. But there are tensions there. But South Africa will, I believe, it will muddle through. But muddle's going to be right, I think.
Do those tensions amount to nothing more than teething difficulties, or are there genuine intercommunal problems in the country?
I think intercommunal ones can always surface, you know. But I think the main problem is there's some corruption, obviously. And those, of course, get fed into kind of tribal difficulties. But I think South Africa will pull through. I believe it. I have to believe it.
And just finally, when you look back on your life and think of all the things you've been through, all the things you've done, what are you most proud of?
I think I've been fortunate and lucky to live through a very interesting period of history, and South Africa's history particularly. I'm proud of the novel, I'm proud of the plays, I'm proud of the short stories. I feel I've underachieved, though.
What have you learnt about yourself?
I'm inclined to let things slide a bit.
You and me both?
Well,
me and you both?
Maybe, I don't know about you. I mean, Jenny's a ball of fire, but I should have done more. I feel I've underachieved.
You've done quite a lot, though.
Yeah, I'm not ashamed.
Yeah.
I'm not ashamed, but I'm not patting myself on the back, you know.
And when you say you're not ashamed, I mean, obviously, when you were sent to prison, you committed an offence under South African law that you would feel was justifiable overall.
Oh, yeah. I think we were forced by the shootings at Sharpeville. I wish I'd done more. I feel I've underachieved, but I'm not ashamed. I put nobody in jail. There was pressure on people to turn state witness. And you know what happened to the African resistance movement, which I enjoyed, the sabotage group, was that they picked up some people in the Cape, and then there was the falling dominoes. As under pressure, people spoke to the police. Now, don't blame them for that. What I do blame is that some of them then went into the witness box. I was told by the special branches, of course they would. They said to me, David, you're a decent sort of fellow. You've got a wife, you've got a stepdaughter. Why don't you just testify for the state, you know, and you won't go to jail? And I said, I just can't do it, you know. And though I confessed to what I'd done, I gave no names away. I was asked about people, and I think I saved one or two from getting arrested by not giving names in, but the pressure to give away names. I was asked about people who had been members of the ARM. The Russells, for instance, were a couple I was very fond of, and I was asked about them. And I didn't exactly lie. I said I just knew them socially, because I knew the special branch knew. But I didn't say they were members of the ARM.
Thanks very much then to Dave for his time and wonderful stories. And thanks also to Dave's partner, Jenny, for the cake. It was amazing. Okay, to the business end of the podcast. Which track have I chosen by The Vow? Well, it's this one, Free the World.
Right. him my old friend. We've been together since I don't know when. Brought me nothing but bad luck. Nothing but bad luck, you know that. I want, I want.